day on Against the Grain, how important have empire and colonialism been to the making of modern societies? How persistent have the legacies of imperial expansion and the subjugation of colonized people been? I'm CS. The sociologist Julian Goh joins me to discuss what post-colonial theory reveals about societies past and present in both the global north and the global south, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Nearly every society in the world today is either a former colony or a former imperial power. How then should we regard and understand processes of imperialism and colonialism? Are they over, so to speak? Should they be dismissed as something we've moved beyond? Or does colonialism in some sense persist? Do its legacies continue to affect and haunt us today? According to Julian Goh, a sociology professor at Boston University, a body of thought called post-colonial theory has for many years sought to illuminate the workings of empire and colonialism, especially on the level of knowledge production and culture more generally. Julian Goh is the author of Postcolonial Thought and Social Theory, and he wrote a chapter on postcolonial theory for the new volume Social Theory Now, edited by Claudio Benzacri, Monica Krauss, and Isaac Reed. When Julian Goh joined me recently from Boston, I asked him how important colonialism and imperialism have been to the making of modern societies.
Well, the claim of the body of thought and writing that I'm calling post-colonial theory is exactly that empire, colonialism have been crucial, essential for the making of modern society. It shaped modern capitalism, the economic system we live in. It shaped our societies. It shaped our institutions. It shaped the way we think about the world, the way we talk about the world. Everything from philosophical ideas about liberty have been formed in and through colonial relations to race relations, and even the very idea of race, some would claim, was formed through colonialism and empire. So the claim of post-colonial theorists is that it has been crucial for modern society.
Now, the modern empires were, as you write, finally dismantled in the 1960s. So you are saying then that the colonial and imperial past, in a sense, continues into the present?
Yeah, well, I'd say two things. First of all, I think for a lot of people, empire and colonialism is not over, right? America owns still as a colony, I would say, Puerto Rico, other territories. There are First Nations and indigenous peoples who are still subjected to colonialism. But the huge modern empires that took over almost 9/10 of the globe, they have been largely dismantled, at least compared to 100 years ago. And one of the things that, again, post-colonial theory, what I'm calling post-colonial theory, reminds us is that even though officially colonialism is over for a lot of people, not everyone, but for a lot of people, even though officially it's over, its legacies persist, so that even today as we speak, yes, there's a kind of presence of colonialism in what we're thinking, what we're doing, and again, in society all around us. So this is the other key claim. Modern colonialism for many people is over. As a political structure, it's largely over. But as a cultural thing, as a social thing, its legacies still remain.
A lot of people talk about inequalities today. To what extent were those inequalities, or can those inequalities be traced back to the formal colonial and imperial era or eras?
Yeah, this is a good question because it's a great example, I think, of how there are these colonial legacies, these legacies of modern empire and colonialism. And we could talk about, you know, say, international equality, a world of rich nations and poor nations. For the most part, a few exceptions aside, for the most part, the countries that are the wealthiest were those that were the modern colonial powers, and the countries that are the poorest were those that were colonized. And again, there's some exceptions and there's some complexities because it kind of depends upon the type of colonialism we're talking about. But for the most part, the inequalities and international inequalities, wealth between countries, can in many ways be traced to this colonial and imperial process. Inequalities between persons, I think, in the world too, especially if we're talking about racial inequalities, right, in a lot of different societies. The racial inequalities that you see in a lot of the ethnic inequalities between groups, these were also forged in colonialism. So this inequality on all these levels is a great example of how colonialism still lives with us.
You note in this chapter and also in your book, Postcolonial Thought and Social Theory, you also note the existence, the continuing existence of separatist movements. So those you also want to link to or to be characterized as the legacies of colonialism?
Yeah, I think there are some current movements that are seeking independence, people seeking independence from a larger state. In a lot of cases, these are continued decolonial movements. And again, I think the independence movement in Puerto Rico is a good example. I think Catalonia in Spain, a lot of the independence movement thinks of itself as a colonized power. So in many ways, you can think about separatist movements, Quebec even, as a kind of continuation of the decolonizing process, which, you know, on a global scale really began in the 60s, and that these are kind of left over from that in a sense. There's also renewed separatist movements, I think, and I think these are also a legacy of colonialism as well. One thing you got to remember is that when the modern empire sort of took land, when they got together and agreed upon who has what land, and they drew up these boundaries and borders, they were largely arbitrary, dependent upon the whims of the colonizers. And so that process of arbitrarily making borders is still sort of hanging around and created the political context for a lot of these movements today.
Does the word postcolonial in postcolonial thought or theory, does it refer only to the historical phase or the time period after decolonization, right? Because that is sort of the implication of the word postcolonial.
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think it's one of the most common misunderstandings that I hear from a lot of people that, oh, if you say postcolonial thought or postcolonial theory or postcolonialism, you are referring to a historical period. And in one sense, yeah, you can think of postcolonial period as a sort of reality that a country is colonized and then it attains independence, and then in that sense it's postcolonial. But the way in which I use postcolonial when I am talking about postcolonial theory or postcolonial thought, I am using it as I think these postcolonial theorists use it, which is not to refer to a historical moment or to say that colonialism is over, but to say that precisely because colonial legacies persist today, and that for many peoples we're still under colonialism, that what is needed is a true postcolonial mentality, a true postcolonial way of thinking. Postcolonial there is in the sense of a way of thinking, a way of looking at the world that has cast off all of those legacies of colonialism, that isn't bound to the way of thinking and seeing the world that colonialism has imposed upon us. So in that sense, postcolonial here refers to a future state. It's an imagined body of thinking. It's an imagined future society that has finally overthrown all of those legacies of colonialism, which are still with us. So by no means does the term postcolonial imply that colonialism is over. Quite the opposite. It's all about recognizing the persistence of colonialism, how it persists in our culture, and it's calling for a truly postcolonial world in the sense of a world beyond the confines that colonialism has imposed upon us.
You write, Julian, that postcolonial theory is also a critique of knowledge. Explain what you mean.
You know, these postcolonial theorists, and I should probably specify some of these folks I'm talking about, and I'm really referring to a whole group of academics as well as anti-colonial activists who have been writing lots of works and who were active in the 20th century and through the current moment. Some of the people I classify as postcolonial theorists or postcolonial thinkers, whether they be Frantz Fanon, who was writing in the context of the French Empire in the 50s and 60s, or whether it be Edward Said, who was a professor at Columbia. A lot of what the writing is about how colonialism generated and depended upon certain knowledges. Right? So colonialism in the early 20th century required knowledge about the other, about colonized peoples, about the peoples that these colonial states had to rule. And anthropology, social sciences, certain forms of humanist knowledge, these were, in that sense, all born from this need of the colonial powers to know the societies they're ruling. So in many ways, I would say modern social science was largely born from this imperial interest, this need to rule. And we still live with that knowledge today, and we still live with the forms of knowledge. We still live with the types of questions that knowledge is asking today in a lot of sectors of our, say, social science. Now, I'm a sociologist. The discipline of sociology is very complex and internally varied, but sociology was part of those social sciences that was first born in the early 20th century, late 19th century, and a lot of what it was doing, a lot of its concerns were shaped by imperial interests and concerns. And sociology, to some extent, social science, to some extent, carries that legacy. And so postcolonial theory is a critique of knowledge in the sense that it's trying to point out how these seemingly objective social sciences carry with them the traces of this colonial past. And so the critique of knowledge is precisely about trying to point out that knowledge can be tainted by imperial power and to think about ways of overcoming that problem.
Julian Goh is my guest. He is professor of sociology at Boston University, and he's the author of Postcolonial Thought and Social Theory, which has been kind of condensed into a chapter by Julian, a chapter that appears in the new volume Social Theory Now. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you mentioned Frantz Fanon, and there are a number of other kind of first wave, actually, thinkers, first wave postcolonial theorists in your characterization, and perhaps others. So this kind of first wave of postcolonial theorists came from, as you suggested a little earlier, kind of an activist strain. These people were actually working on liberation movements. Who else was part of this first wave?
Yeah, if I may, I mean, I should clarify. Sometimes when you say today, especially in the academy where I work, if you say postcolonial theory, a lot of people have in their head a certain academic trend that largely began in the humanities in the 80s and blew up through the 90s, and this was in literature departments especially, and this academic trend was labeled postcolonial studies, and you had certain stars of this intellectual movement, such as Edward Said, Homi Bhabha, Dipesh Chakrabarty, Gayatri Spivak. And the way I think of this movement, that's the second wave of postcolonial thought. I would argue that those writers and thinkers were really just drawing upon and extending, as you correctly point out, C.S., the first wave. And by first wave, I mean the scholars, activists who were emerging and thinking about the world precisely during the period, the height of modern colonialism in the 20th century. And so Frantz Fanon was one of them. Another I would include in there would be Aimé César, the Martinican poet, writer, philosopher, politician. I would even include W.E.B. Du Bois, who was a sociologist in the early 20th century. You have other people like Amilcar Cabral, who was fighting against the Portuguese Empire. And these are interesting folks because, unlike the second wave, they weren't purely academics. W.E.B. Du Bois was an academic. He was a sociologist at Atlanta University, but he was also an activist, right? He helped founded the NAACP. Frantz Fanon was involved in the liberation movement against France and Algeria. Aimé César was a politician, and Amilcar Cabral was an active anti-Portuguese revolutionary. So you have these core thinkers. I think you could add others to this first wave. I would add, for example, the Marxist writer C.L.R. James. And so, you know, you could put in a lot of different people, but that's just some of the key ones that I think about when I think about this first wave.
And the second wave, which, as you said, drew upon the first wave, what was the agenda of these scholars in the 80s and 90s and beyond? What were they trying to do within the academy?
I think, you know, they each had their different projects, and I don't want to, you know, homogenize them, but I do think that they shared a critique of contemporary humanities knowledge, a critique of literature, for example, what was being discussed in literature, a critique of philosophy and what was being discussed in philosophy, and what was not being discussed. And what they were, I think, trying to get their fellow academics to realize is exactly the legacy of colonialism and imperialism upon knowledge, in this case, academic knowledge. And in that context of the humanities, part of the movement was to critique the Eurocentrism, for example, of the literature canon, right? And I think that this becomes one of the essential elements of this second wave, which was to point out that, you know, when we studied English literature in the 80s, it was, you know, the literature of white men, A, and B, and more precisely, this was literature that was talking about empire in the background, but it wasn't that empire in the background wasn't fully acknowledged. So what they were trying to do, I think, in their context, was to make the academic humanities kind of realize empire and colonialism was crucial for the humanities and to get rid of the sort of Eurocentric assumptions that really reflected this imperial legacy upon the humanities.
Well, you're talking about critiques of empire and of colonialism and an examination of the legacies of imperialism and colonialism. A fair amount of Marxist theory has been critical of empire and of colonialism. So how does, if it does, how does post-colonial thought differ from Marxist theory?
I think that when I look around at the sort of intellectual scene in the 20th century and through today, I would say that there are two main bodies of thought that have recognized the importance of empire and colonialism and have tried to think about its implications for society and for knowledge. One is, of course, these anti-colonial and post-colonial thinkers, the first wave and second wave that I've just mentioned. The other is, of course, Marxism. And the Marxist critique of capitalism brought with it, carried with it, a critique of empire and colonialism, and recognized also that empire and colonialism was important for shaping modern society and that today has all these legacies. And indeed, some of the first wave thinkers, Fanon, Du Bois, they were influenced by Marxist thought. Aimé Césaire was a member of the Communist Party, for instance. So there's common ground, I think, between post-colonial theory and Marxist thought. However, I think there is a distinction to be made, or a series of distinctions to be made. And it's a complex issue, but the simplest way I would put it is the way that Aimé Césaire and some of these post-colonial thinkers at the time put it, which is Marxism is important for understanding capitalism, but as a set of theoretical tools for understanding the world and for critiquing the world and for thinking about possibilities for change, it's incomplete. Because what it missed was questions of culture, questions of particularly race and racial difference. And so the post-colonial thinkers drew from Marx, but were, let's say, unhappy with the way in which at least certain variants of Marxism ignored race and kind of reduced everything to class. Now, you know, this is, I think, a fair critique, because the Communist Party that Aimé Césaire was a member of, and which he later resigned from precisely because they overlooked questions of race. The Communist Party, these other strands of Marxism, I think, can be accused of overlooking the importance of race. And for the postcolonial thinkers, empire and colonialism is all about race. It was built upon racial difference. It brought with it all of these racial inequalities. And so it's crucial to focus upon race. But certain brands of Marxism, particularly that of the Communist Party, did ignore questions of race. Marx himself, I think, it's a complicated issue which we can get into. Some might argue that Marx did write about race and talk about race, and there's a great book by Kevin Anderson called Marx at the Margins, who points out that Marx has all these journalistic writings about the Civil War and about all these issues which did incorporate questions of race. But, you know, my own contention, and I think this would be the contention of some of the other postcolonial thinkers, is that even then, even, you know, granted that there's a type of Marxism that did talk about race, I still think that Marx's theory of capitalism can be accused of sort of bracketing race under the rug and really not taking it seriously enough.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Julian Goh, teaches sociology at Boston University. His books include Patterns of Empire, The British and American Empires, 1688 to Present, and American Empire and the Politics of Meaning. And we are talking about some of the arguments he puts forward in his book, Postcolonial Thought and Social Theory, that was published by Oxford University Press. Yeah, on this race question, so let's just take the agent of revolution, according to Karl Marx. He certainly foregrounded workers, the proletariat. And to what degree do you think his characterization of workers or the workers that he looked to for revolutionary inspiration, to what extent was that inflected by race?
Yeah, I think, again, this is a complex issue, for some very controversial. For me, it's quite simple, and that is that when Marx built his theory of capitalism, which is foremost articulated in his work Das Kapital, this three-volume, wonderful, brilliant work that analyzes and critiques capitalism and how it works and where it's going and all of the contradictions of capitalism. In that work, you know, Marx is really basing his model after what was going on in England at the time. And look, all social scientists, when they come up with theories, have implicitly or explicitly some empirical reference, some model, some example that they're thinking of upon which they base their entire theory. And it seems to me, from what I can tell of Marx's writing, when Marx is writing about capitalism and the relations between capitalists and workers, he was primarily thinking of the white wage worker in England. That was his model. That then informs how he understands labor relations and informs how he understands the development of capitalism over time and how he understands who the vanguard of history will be, who the proletariat is. And it's, in that sense, largely white. Now, you know, I wonder, and I think this is also the point of some of these postcolonial theorists and other strands of Marxism like Black Marxism, which is a whole separate school, which is connected in some ways to postcolonial theory. But the point there is that, you know, what if Marx had based his theory not on the wage relation between the white employer and the white worker in England, but rather the slave owner and the slave on the Caribbean plantation in the 18th century? What if he had based his whole model of capitalism upon that? Well, his theory would probably look different. His idea of who the vanguard or the revolutionary agent would probably be different too, and it would be not white workers. So, you know, this modeling one's social theory after Europe, this kind of Eurocentrism, does lead to certain political visions about who should lead the revolution, so to speak, that, you know, I think in many ways Marx can be rightfully accused of overlooking the vast majority of types of workers around the world, not least slave workers.
Didn't Karl Marx, by talking about primitive accumulation, didn't he recognize and acknowledge how the extraction and the appropriation of resources from colonized parts of the world, fed into the expansion of capitalism?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. There is that wonderful section in Capital and in some of his other writings where he says that the wealth of Europe was built upon this wealth from the colonies, and that there was a process that he called primitive accumulation, which was a violent process, the early stages of colonialism, of the British going in and just taking land in India violently. And this whole process that he calls primitive accumulation, which he does say was important for capitalism, but I think the critique from the postcolonial side is that what Marx didn't do is recognize the continuing importance of those forms of accumulation. That, you know, one reading of Marx is that he relegated primitive accumulation to a passing phase, right? It's something that happens early in capitalism and then disappears once capitalism takes off, and then capitalism takes on this basic wage labor, free wage labor form. Now, I think that this, for postcolonial scholars who are, you know, remember, they're writing and thinking about how capitalism looks, not from England or the United States necessarily, but how it looks from the Caribbean, from Asia, from Africa. And when you look at labor in those contexts, and you look at capitalism in those contexts, I think it becomes hard to say that the forms of violence and coercion that Marx talked about with primitive accumulation, it's hard to say that that was a sort of passing phase that just sort of went away and that was the basis for capitalism. I mean, from the perspective of the global south and the colonized world at the time, primitive accumulation was a continual process. Colonialism continued to be violent. Labor continued to be not a free wage labor relation, but involving all kinds of coerced labor that, yes, even after formal slavery ended, there was these continued forms of coercive labor. So this is another example of where Marx's theory, I think, for post-colonial theorists is somewhat helpful, but also kind of relegates questions of race, relegates things like primitive accumulation, relegates all these things that for post-colonial thinkers are crucial for what's going on in the world. He relegates them to the kind of theoretical margins, and that is a problem.
And if we move beyond Marx, I mean, to what extent is kind of a hallmark of post-colonial thought this critique of Eurocentrism, not just in a thinker like Marx, but really in many thinkers, this desire to move away from seeing Europe as sort of the center of all things and the originator of all things?
Yeah, I think this is one of the legacies of the what I would call the imperial episteme, that is the way in which imperial powers and certain people, certain elites in the imperial metropoles looked about the world and thought about the world. That's what I'm calling the imperial episteme. I think one of the legacies of the imperial episteme is precisely this Eurocentrism, but not Eurocentrism in this kind of sense of, oh, I have an attitude that Europe is superior. Eurocentrism as a kind of way of thinking. Eurocentrism in the meaning of assuming that Europe is the center of history, the originator of history, that Europeans are the sole agents of history, and they are the builders of history. This persists not just in popular discourse, and I could give you lots of interesting examples, but it persists also in certain sectors of social thought, in certain sectors of social science. So this idea that the white European settlers, for example, are the sole agents of history, there are theories, for example, that take that remnant of the imperial episteme, that take that as fact and say that, well, you know, when you look historically, the countries that did the best economically were those that had white settlers, right? Because white settlers brought all these wonderful institutions. That's a kind of theory that gets kicked around. Certain empirical evidence is marshaled for it. But that's a theory that is reflective of this Eurocentric assumption that white imperialists are the only makers of history. And that is also reflected in popular discourse. When you see, for example, certain American nativist movements today. I mean, nativist as in this idea that America, you know, America first, and their claims that, you know, Mexicans and Chinese need to get out of America because, you know, Americans are the ones, white Americans are the ones that built this country. That's the same discourse as this theoretical assumption that white Europeans, white imperialists are the makers of history.
Julian Goh is his name. He teaches sociology at Boston University. We'll take a short break and speak more with him about post-colonial thought and social theory. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Julian Goh is professor of sociology at Boston University. And I came across a chapter he wrote on post-colonial thought that is part of a new volume. It's called Social Theory Now. It's edited by Claudio Benzacri, Monica Krauss, and Isaac Reed, and it's published by University of Chicago Press. And that chapter condenses to some extent a book that Julian Goh wrote called Postcolonial Thought and Social Theory. Julian Goh is also the editor of the journal Political Power and Social Theory. Edward Said, he identified and critiqued what he called the law of division. What's that?
Said's notion of the law of division, this is one of his interesting ideas that's tied to his larger idea about what he called Orientalism. And he has this book, Orientalism, which was published in the late 1970s and became a kind of canonical piece for what I'm calling the second wave of postcolonial thought. And so the law of division is a sort of law that operates in the imperial episteme. It's a way in which imperialists, Said contends, it's the way in which they think, right? And one part of the way in which they think is to divide up the world into the East and West, the West and the rest, with the assumption that the West is best, that the Europeans or the Anglo-Europeans are superior. And the other related point of this law of division goes back to this question of the agency of the colonized versus the agency of white Europeans. Because if you're an imperialist and you're thinking about the world according to this law of division, and you're thinking of East versus West, and that the West is best, you're also not only going to think of the East, you're going to think of it as this homogeneous, you know, place. All Arabs, for example, are the same. That's a key aspect of this law of division and Orientalism. You're also going to think of yourself as superior, and you're going to also think of yourself as the sole agent of history. So this idea that white Europeans are the agents of history, it's a part of this law of division. And what it fails to recognize, of course, is that white Europeans, the wealth of white Europe at the time, the advancements that they made, all of this was not separate from what was going on in the so-called East. It was dependent upon it. So the wealth from the colonies helped generate the wealth of Europe, and there was an entanglement or a connection there between East and West that the law of division sort of ignores or represses and still insists on seeing the East and West as separate. So it's a very interesting idea. It relates to sort of racial stereotypes, cultural stereotypes that imperialists have that are part of the imperial episteme, and it also relates to these assumptions about agency and who's really the maker of history. And for me, it's particularly pernicious because it denies the agency of colonized peoples. It forces us to not recognize that the history of European society is bound up for centuries, has been bound up for centuries with the so-called non-West. It's bound up through colonialism.
Does Edward Said's law of division, does that relate to M.A. Césaire's notion that Europe, I guess the notion was that Europe is kind of a self-contained entity distinct from its colonial peripheries. And, you know, to what extent did Césaire challenge that, and to what extent does that kind of relate to what you were saying about Edward Said saying, no, you know, the colonizer and the colonized, or the colonial nation and the colonized nation, are not in fact separate and distinct?
So this is one of those common themes that you see in postcolonial theory, and you're exactly right. It's an excellent point. M.A. Césaire wrote about in this book, Discourse on Colonialism, which was written at the height of European colonialism in the 20th century. One of the many things he points out in that book is that, you know, we tend to think of colonialism as something that impacts the colonized, right? That colonialism comes in and it either degrades the colonized, or to your imperialists at the time who were pro-empire at the time, it civilizes the colonized people. But what Césaire pointed out is that there is a deeper connection that's forged through colonialism, such that it's not just that colonialism impacts the colonized, it's that it also impacts the colonizer, right? It also impacts Europe. And so Césaire's point was that the colonizer becomes in many ways corrupted by the colonial experience. They find themselves exploiting colonized peoples. They find themselves degrading the colonized and thereby degrading themselves. one great example he gave was World War II and Hitler. Right? Cesar's writing around this time, and he looks at Hitler's occupation of Poland and Hitler's attempt to take over Europe. He says, hey, this is just colonialism come home to roost, right? This is what Europeans have been doing overseas for centuries, and now they're doing it at home, and that they're, in a sense, so corrupted by this experience of colonialism overseas that they're applying it to themselves in Europe. And Cesar's related point was, precisely because colonialism degrades and dehumanizes the colonizer just as it does the colonized, Europe can no longer claim, if it ever could, to be the bringer of civilization to the world, and that we need to look elsewhere for thinking about who's going to truly bring about civilization to the world.
So the colonizing nations, the metropoles, they obviously, you know, when they go out and do their imperial or colonial thing, they try and impose a kind of order on those others, right? Whether it be in India or in Africa or wherever. So in other words, they try and develop certain techniques for the maintenance of social order abroad in the colonies. What do you want to say about the extent to which those techniques were used or adapted by the colonizing power in the metropole itself?
Postcolonial theorists talk about and point to a number of ways in which, you know, colonialism comes home to roost. One example I can give from my recent research is on the militarization of the police. Now, we tend to think of the militarization of the police as something that's happened only recently in the United States, but in the early 20th century, police departments were also militarizing in the sense of trying to mimic and use military techniques. Well, one of the things that was going on at the time was the Philippine-American War and the occupation of the Philippines by the United States and the American army overseas to suppress the independence movement in the Philippines was developing various counterinsurgency techniques, and these then appear back home, used by the police, actually, because some of the police chiefs of departments in the United States had served in the Philippine-American War. And so in the 1910s and 1920s, for example, newspapers started writing about how this torture technique called the water cure, which is a variant of waterboarding, if you remember from the Iraq War, the water cure was being used by police on U.S. citizens in American cities. Now, the water cure was a method of interrogation that the Americans first used where? Well, they used in the Philippines against Filipino insurgents. And so that's another example of how things that were being done in the colonies sort of come home and impact the colonizing societies as well.
Yeah, impacts specifically marginalized people within those colonizing societies, or maybe we should say agitators, dissenters within those colonizing societies.
Yes, and so the other interesting thing about some of these post-colonial thinkers is that they're pointing out equivalences between the way in which colonizers are treating colonized people overseas and the way in which populations within the metropole, right, in the American case, African-Americans, maybe Chinese, Hispanics, are treated by the state as well. And there's all these equivalences between how these racialized subjects, both at home and abroad, are treated. And that's another sort of aspect of colonialism, and it's another legacy of colonialism.
Julian Goh is his name. He is professor of sociology at Boston University. One of his books is Postcolonial Thought and Social Theory, and he's got a chapter on postcolonial thought in the new volume called Social Theory Now. It's published by University of Chicago Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So one could forgive, or one could understand if someone like Edward Said thought, well, you know, we have all these narratives, and they're all, and so many of them are Eurocentric and foreground and highlight and prioritize the narratives of people in the West and white folks in the West. Let's go our separate ways and just develop narratives that apply to formerly colonized people or people who are now subject to, you know, what you might call neo-imperialism. But Edward Said did not do that, right? He did not try and seek narratives or encourage the formation of narratives that were just specific to formerly colonized people.
You're exactly right. And this is an important point, I think, not only regarding Said's vision of what to do, but also post-colonial thinkers generally. And if you remember, I mentioned earlier one of the key aspects of, well, one of the projects of post-colonial thought is to create knowledge that goes beyond the imperial episteme. So it's post-colonial in the sense that it goes beyond the confines of colonialist thinking and tries to transcend these colonialist ways of thinking. And the immediate thought that someone might have about how to create this post-colonial knowledge, right? How to overcome this problem of the law of division or overcome this problem of overlooking the agency of colonized peoples, the immediate thought might be, well, let's just not look at Europe anymore, as you say, C.S., and just look at, say, let's write African-centered histories or Asian-centered histories and so on and so on. Now, I think that there's something to that, but that's not really what Said and I think these other post-colonial thinkers truly meant when they're envisioning a post-colonial knowledge. Because, I mean, Said points out the problem with that is that it's a kind of reverse Orientalism. Now, not reverse racism, which is a different term, but it reinscribes and reproduces the law of division, right? So you replace Eurocentrism with an Afrocentrism. And what that misses are these precisely the connections, the shared histories, the entangled histories, and the relations between these two places. And so you can't just replace Eurocentrism with an Afrocentrism. Doing so will reproduce the very law of division that was in the imperial episteme and that one is ostensibly trying to overcome. One way to really overcome the law of division is to recognize these connections, to recognize these relations, rather than sort of just focus on one side or the other.
You mentioned earlier about how post-colonial theorists say that so much of mainstream theory ignores people in the colonized nations, in the formerly colonized nations. One post-colonial approach is one that starts with the standpoint of the subaltern. How would you define subalterns or the subaltern?
Yeah, the subaltern, it's a weighted term. In intellectual sort of academic discourse, people usually trace it to the neo-Marxist thinker Antonio Gramsci, who was an Italian philosopher, and he used this term largely in the context of talking about the sort of working class. But post-colonial thinkers, largely of the second wave, pick up this term as well. One branch of the second wave is what's called the subaltern studies, which is a group of Indian historians, largely coming out of India, who are trying to rewrite the history of India and to sort of deal exactly with this problem of an overemphasis upon the British colonizer or the colonizer's history and to kind of write a history from below. And so they use this term subaltern. And again, it's a complex term, but what it really refers to is just the group of people who are marginalized. In any society, at any time, you will have a group of people who are marginalized by society, who are exploited, oppressed, and in some societies, that might be a group of people who are of a particular race. In another society, it might be a group of people who are a particular race and of gender, and so on and so on. And so the subaltern is a kind of catch-all term to get us to think about these marginalized or oppressed people in any context. So that's really the sort of most basic notion of the subaltern. And I think we can think about a global subaltern. If you think about the global system of the world, a global society, then you know, you can think about these subalterns that are, in a sense, the group of people who are oppressed at the bottom of the global hierarchy.
And subalterns, they have, as many post-colonial thinkers have acknowledged and recognized, they have their own knowledges, their kind of indigenous knowledges. To what extent is the project of at least some post-colonial theorists the elevation, the bringing to light of these indigenous knowledges, and how do you feel about that? Like, is that something that you can get behind? Because it does sound a little bit like it's in tension with Edward Said's notion or belief that we need to construct narratives that are common to all, right? Because the experiences of the ruler and the ruled can't be disentangled.
Yeah, that's an important point, and it's a complex one. I think that what I would say is that the short answer is that the sort of focusing upon the subaltern as a way to rethink our narratives and to rethink our knowledge and our theories should be a starting point, but not the end point. Okay, so there's a crucial background here, which is that, you know, all knowledge is based upon the concerns and interests of a certain group of people. Social sciences, which is the disciplines that I work in, particularly sociology, was founded in the early 20th century, and a lot of the questions it's asked and the things it was concerned with, and therefore the research and theories that it produced, in many ways reflected the interests of white male elites in the metropole. So one solution to that problem is to reorient, readjust our attempts at gathering knowledge by taking more seriously not the concerns of white male elites in the metropole, but take seriously the concerns and experiences of the subaltern, right, the group of the marginalized groups. And I think in itself, if you just sort of only focused attention on the voices and experiences of the subaltern, that could run into this problem of not overcoming the law of division, because then you might end up with these narratives that are just Afrocentric or Asian-centric or, you know, subaltern-centric. But I think that when you actually look at examples of theorists and writers who did start from the subaltern standpoint, such as these postcolonial theorists themselves, I would say Fanon, for example, or W.E.B. Du Bois, a lot of their writings began from the standpoint of the colonized. When you look at the writings, you see that they end up not remaining purely Afrocentric or Asian-centric. They don't run into this problem of reproducing the law of division, because I think what they tap into is how subaltern experience is an experience of domination by these colonial forces, right, and the colonial legacies. And so by starting with the experience of the subaltern, I think that you end up overcoming the law of division, because the standpoint of the subaltern possibly, I think most often, offers a distinct lens that is able to see these larger global relations of colonial oppression, and maybe in a way that the standpoint of the white male elite in the metropole doesn't see. So I think, yeah, there are risks to valorizing the subaltern standpoint, romanticizing this subaltern group, but I think that if it's done carefully, what it can generate is a better understanding of the world that does take into account these larger complex forces and relations that the law of division and the imperial episteme kind of overlooks.
That's Julian Goh, professor of sociology at Boston University. What about this issue of the truth and where we find truth and objectivity, right? Because post-colonial thinkers, they obviously cast a very skeptical eye on claims of truth made in Western mainstream circles that highlight European and white experiences and knowledges. And then, but you're also kind of saying that, you know, we can't maybe totally throw ourselves behind indigenous knowledges, because that would create a kind of imbalance of its own. So is there kind of an issue or a dilemma around, in your opinion, around truth and where it can be found and where it should be located?
Yeah, this is a very important question, I think, for it was an important question for the postcolonial theorists, and it's a question for actually me as a social scientist, as a sociologist. And, you know, we do have to understand, first of all, that, you know, the postcolonial critique is of knowledge in the sense that knowledge has been used non-objectively. The scientific racism of the late 19th century is a perfect example, and this is another legacy of colonialism. You know, the idea of race, I think most scholars will tell you, is born from the colonial relation, that colonists, imperialists confronted these other peoples to make sense of them. One of the categories they invented was racial difference and biological difference. And then they use that to justify their domination of the world, to justify why they should rule other peoples. So there is a real critique of claims to objectivity. But I think that I worry that some people read into that something different than it is, right? One of the things I think that uncareful readers or uncareful thinkers will walk away from after hearing this argument is that, oh, so the postcolonial theorists, they don't believe in truth. There's no such thing as pure objectivity. It's all tainted. And I don't think that's really the lesson that we want to take, and I don't think that's what postcolonial theorists are saying. I think that one of the things they're doing is, first of all, pointing out the hypocrisy to claims of objectivity, right? So scientific racism claims to be science and henceforth objective, but the postcolonial critique is to highlight how actually it's used to justify and legitimate these structures and systems and institutions, and so it's not objective in that sense. That's the first point. The second point is that postcolonial theorists aren't saying that objectivity isn't possible. They're saying that we need a stronger objectivity. And there's a philosopher named Sandra Harding who talks about this in the context of feminist theory, and she calls it strong objectivity. And, you know, it's complex, but the basic notion is that to critique claims of objectivity in science does not mean that you don't believe that true scientific knowledge is possible. It just means that you find that the scientific knowledge that you're looking at is actually not being used in an objective way. So my own take is that to read postcolonial theory as being kind of a postmodern relativism is very much off the mark. And I'll just give one example from sociology. If sociology is too narrowly concerned, because it's following the law of division in the imperial episteme, if it's only, say, focusing upon the agency of white imperialists and not recognizing the contributions of colonized peoples, that's not good science to me, right? It's missing this important causal factor in society. It's missing how colonialism and colonized peoples are actually important shapers of society. And to me, that's an incomplete scientific claim. So one of the things that postcolonial theory gets me to try to think about is that our sociology needs to be more objective and more scientific by taking into account colonial histories, by taking into account how the rest of the world has contributed to modern society. I mean, look, the United States has 4% of the world's population. Europe has about 12%. That means that the rest of the world, 84% of the rest of the world, and yet, you know, most of our social science, when it talks about society, when it talks about what's happening in society, only focuses upon the agency of that 16%. That is not scientific, right, because it's missing all kinds of other things. So that's how I would respond to this sort of question about, well, you know, can there be objective truth? I don't think that is at stake, really, with postcolonial theory.
That's the voice of Julian Goh. He is professor of sociology at Boston University. The book he's been talking about is Postcolonial Thought and Social Theory. It's published by Oxford University Press. And he wrote a chapter on postcolonial thought for the new volume Social Theory Now. Julian, thanks so much for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you, C.S.
And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.